Welcome to Warships Pod, and returning as my special guest this time is Gary Blackburn. And Dr. Gary Blackburn, no less, is an honorary fellow of the Centre for Security Studies at the University of Hull, which seeks to enhance understanding on the nature of war and strategy, while also providing guidance on best practice in war and strategy to professional stakeholders. Gary has taught security studies and military history at the universities of Leeds and Hull, respectively. Welcome back, Gary.
Thank you, Ian. Great to be here as always, and plenty to get our teeth into again, unfortunately.
Yeah, exactly. Unfortunately, plenty to talk about. And I suppose the thing we could kick off this time in this episode for our chat is, first of all, following the theme of home and away, is what's happening at home with naval defence and geopolitics related to that, and also economic and political aspects of it, which is the Strategic Defence Review, which is called Strategic Defence Review, Making Britain Safer, Secure at Home and Strong Abroad. So that ties in with our home and away approach. So it was a long time in the making, with a very distinguished team of independent experts looking into how Britain should shape its defences. And it was instituted and initiated by the new Labour government, as it was a year ago. So then, for the benefit of our listeners, it then delivered the defence review paper about, 4 weeks ago, I think it was. And so we all got our teeth into that. And it set the context by saying, the world has changed. The threats we now face are more serious and less predictable than at any time since the end of the Cold War. This review sets out a vision to make Britain safer, secure, at home and strong abroad. So you've had a read of it, Gary. I've had a read of it. What did you make to it, the Strategic Defence Review in general?
Well, I thought, to be honest, it was a bit of a fudged document. Some of the elements within it I would agree with. We'll come on to those in a second. But what was really strange about it was just the nature and the character of the document itself, and also the briefing around the document, particularly the day before the publication. So it was published on a Monday, and we had a lot of briefings in the press on the Sunday, particularly the Telegraph and the Times. And it turned out that some of the leaks that were in the press didn't actually manifest in the document itself, which was a shame, because the leaks were actually a bit more interesting than the document in the round, which creates a sense of mystery, really. And when I read it the first time, I was thinking, I think there must be two versions of this document. I mean, there are probably many, but I'm thinking this version here feels like a placeholder. It doesn't really feel like the final document, because, you know, even though the authors had used 40,000 words, they didn't say a tremendous amount. I mean, there's some good stuff in there, which we'll come on to, I'm sure. But it was, if I compare it to the 1998 Strategic Defence Review, which obviously the Secretary of State then was George Robertson, and he was one of the key sponsors of this document as well. You know, that document, the 98 one, was conceptually very clear, but it pulled through those high policy points that it made about the end of the Cold War, the rise of nationalist and religious forces, pulled it through very neatly into what the structure of the Navy and the Army and the Air Force therefore should look like. It had much more of an expeditionary feel to it. And we were moving away from what was then, you know, the tight focus on NATO. And so obviously, I mean, one of the kind of the tropes in the current document is, a NATO first approach, which is fine. We'll come on to that as well, I guess, when we go on into the substance of it. Anyway, so it kind of raised a lot of questions, and it raised a lot of eyebrows, and probably generated more questions than answers, really. But having dug around, you know, listening to some of the Defence Select Committee interviews on this, including Admiral Radigan, Chief of the Defence Staff, and also the main sponsors, so Robertson, General Barons, and the academic Fiona Hill, and also just some of the commentary around some of the more specialist publications out there, start to piece together what's actually gone on. And what seems to have actually gone on is that the 2.5% financial envelope that we're going to hit 2.5% by 2027 is has allowed them to write what they've written, but much of what they'd presumably like to flesh out is dependent upon hitting 3% of GDP investment for defence. But that isn't guaranteed in the document. It talks about if economic and fiscal conditions allow, okay? So it's contingent on some unknowns in the future. So the real document we would like to have seen, something which would have been fit to address the scale of the challenges, which the document outlines, is not there. It's kind of absent. And it's telling, therefore. So when you actually watch the parliamentary accounts, particularly with Lord Robertson, what those witnesses are basically saying is that, yes, we've only got 2.5% to play with at the moment. But if you wanted to scale things up, if you wanted to move more quickly on some of the substance in the command paper, then you can do that. So in other words, if the threat gets really out of control, or if, and we'll come on to talk about the forthcoming NATO summit, because of course since the publication, Mark Rutte, the NATO Secretary General, has been saying that basically everyone's going to have to pay 3.5% of GDP. And the chair of the committee put it to George Robertson, do you feel like uncomfortable or a bit embarrassed that you were asked to pull together a document based on 2.5 rising to 3? First of all, the 3 is not guaranteed. And then a few days later, Mark Rutte is telling everybody, look, to keep Donald Trump and the Americans happy, 3.5% is the base that we're all going to have to hit. So I think, Ian, I think that's why it came across not so much as jam tomorrow, but just a big block of fudge.
And I was thinking that it seemed to me that they came in with their idea of a defence review, as all governments do, and they want to do a crash bang wallop. The Tories did it along with the Lib Dems in 2010. Crash bang wallop. We'll get rid of frigates. We'll get rid of people. We'll cut the Nimrod MRA-4, and then about the carriers. Oh, we'll just have one. It'll have cats and traps. So I think governments, as I'm sure you probably agree, come in with an intention of being a new broom and also making an impression, and then reality as things go on catches up with them. So it seems to me what you're suggesting there is that they found themselves as they went through the review process in a straitened economic situation, and the government was trying to figure all that out and try not to make cuts, and then doing cuts like the winter fuel allowance and threatening to cut welfare, and then thinking, oh, that's gone down very badly, so maybe we can't do that. And so as you are suggesting there, the money that they wanted, up to 3%, and the certainty disappeared out the window.
Well, yes, exactly. And one of the specific thing which went missing in action was the on the Sunday in the Times, I think, there was talk of expanding the escort fleet up to 25 vessels.
Right.
Which would effectively mean, obviously, you'd have your 6 Type 45s, you'd have your 8 Type 26s, 5 Type 2031s in build, and then another 5 or 6, I guess, Type 31 Batch 2 or Type 32, whatever nomenclature you want to use. Now, it would appear that that was actually an option discussed during the process, but that requires 3%. And therefore, at the 11th hour, so I've read, the 3%, the Treasury intervened to prevent that being put forward as an option, is what some elements of the media are saying. So they must have got that from somewhere. And clearly, the Sunday Times got the story from a well-placed source. So I think that's indicative of the fact, as you hint there, that, you know, the public finances are under a degree of strain in the round. So you have two competing realities. You've got what a fiscal hawk would call the fiscal reality of the debt situation, and in particular, the yields that the government are having to play on their bonds at the moment. But on the other side of the coin, on the other side of the ledger, we've got the strategic reality of the threats posed by Russia and China and their allies, such as Iran. But more fundamental than that, as I've said before, is actually Donald Trump. So, you know, America is, we don't know. And I think reading between the lines, one of the reasons why it's such a fudge document is they don't know precisely what the Americans are going to do. So they don't, the drawdown from NATO, the form and the shape of that, and the pivot towards the Indo-Pacific region on behalf of the Americans, there are elements of that which are not known. So therefore, I think that probably, I'm guessing here, it's pure speculation, that probably gave the Treasury the wriggle room to clamp down on things like a 25 escort navy, even though strategic logic would argue very firmly for that. And with regards to the SSNs, the AUKUS SSNs, another example where it's not so much we're going to have 12 SSNs, but we're going to have up to 12 SSNs, which again gives wriggle room. Yeah. Because again, you know, if we're spending 3% or 3.5% of GDP on defence by 2030, then that might be sufficient to get 12 SSNs and 25 escorts. That might be enough. That might be all we need. And enough sailors, critically, to actually man them. So it might be, if I'm being kind, it might be that it's just they're not quite sure which way the Americans are going to go. And so they're kind of hoping that something might come up. But obviously, as you suggest, there's the domestic political imperatives. And I don't really want to go too far down that track. But, you know, it ties in with things like, what does the Office for Budget Responsibility think about this? What does the Financial Times think about this? So because I think I'm right in saying that, take the Financial Times, you might think it's just a paper, a financial paper, which it is on one level, but I'm fairly confident that whatever sentiment it's expressing on any given day about a particular government or a particular policy feeds directly into the algorithms that the financial community uses, which is quite scary in a way, because it's basically taking judgment out of the equation and relying on sentiment. And the problem is, as we know, that fiscal hawks will say, well, you know, you've got to be realistic. You can't have fantasy fleets. You have to live within your means. But the reality is that economic security and physical military security are two sides of the same coin. You can't have one without the other. And to Robertson's credit, he makes this point in the committee hearings. There's not much point. You know, if you go back to 2010 SDSR, which was probably my least favourite SDSR, they made the point right at the beginning that the UK's strategic centre of gravity was its AAA credit rating, which was obviously nonsense and unfortunate, because a couple of weeks later, the UK lost its AAA credit rating. But that was a justification used for cutting Ark Royal, the Harriers, etc., is that we had to keep the bond markets happy. But there will, if we go too far with that logic, there will be no bond markets. And that's the unequivocal, unambiguous lesson of history, particularly from a British perspective.
Yeah, I mean, looking at it overall and looking at the naval elements, they've got terms in there.
Yeah.
I'm just looking at our cheat sheet that I prepared.
Yes.
Sure. Before we convened this, you got things like new hybrid navy, dreadnought, trident submarines, the new ones, SSN AUKUS, the new attack submarine that you mentioned, the 12 that's supposed to come with construction beginning by 2030 for the UK, up to 12, and I believe there's up to 8 for the Australians. Hence, it's called SSN AUKUS after the Australia UK US. Defence Pact. And then it's got things like later on, the thing which I think is, to me, is a pointer towards the fact that they devised aspects of this on getting those extra frigates, and then they were chucked out, which is the Atlantic Bastion, because it talks about combining drones, RAF, maritime patrol aircraft, the hydrographic service, and its, you know, its ability to survey waters to pin down where likely enemies might lurk, and, you know, defensive areas, and also frigates. And it talks about frigates, and frigates with mission bays for drones, and working in conjunction with helicopters and submarines, and also the RAF's maritime patrol aircraft. Now, with 8 anti-submarine warfare frigates, you're not going to have many more in future. When they eventually arrive, which is years from now, what, two or three at a time? And how on earth you're going to create a bastion when you've also got other jobs for those warships, and you might have multiple roaming Russian submarines trying to get into the North Atlantic. I don't know. And then beyond all that, there's the whole idea of a bastion. It's a very defensive mindset. And in fact, the Russians operate in their own bastion up in the high north in the Arctic, and they probably won't come out of their bastion because they don't need to, because their missiles have got the range to hit us from up there. They don't need to come through. So weird, in some ways, weird, old-fashioned, passive constructs like the bastion concept, which we'll come back to in future editions of the magazine, seem to me to indicate that they don't, as you say, they've got a concept where they don't have the ability to fulfill it in the first place, but also that they're reaching for things where drones are a magic answer, where a few frigates can maybe do something. But the reality is it's not going to be much of a defence against missiles coming from the Russian bastion in the high north. And also, I don't think two or three frigates and one or two maritime patrol aircraft and a few drones will make much of a bastion. So there's that. So I think that's an indicator. But turning towards NATO, because you said we could talk about NATO, coming straight down the road from the poor UK news economically, which then tightened what the SDR could promise by way of force structure or what it could try and fulfil. We then, of course, almost immediately, apart from the uncertainty about what the Americans are going to do about NATO and how much they're going to pivot towards Indo-Pacific and take stuff out of Europe, we then have NATO, and as we're talking, there's a summit coming up where there's going to be a push to take, I believe, the minimum GDP to be a member of the alliance from 3.5% to an ambition of 5%. So the government must be in an even more desperate need of finding a solution. And one of the things I thought we could talk about was creative accounting. So what do you think to the NATO pressure and the desire for creative accounting in the defence budget?
Well, yeah, no, it's a really great point. I think... So 3.5%, I actually think that's about right. That's what we should be heading towards sooner rather than later. But you have to start with what do we currently have, which is 2.3%, rising to 2.5% by 2027. And now, I don't want to segue too much into this, but a lot of people are really critical of using GDP metrics in relation to defence because they say things like, well, GDP is a moving feast, so what? To be honest, I think that's quite disingenuous because saying it's a moving feast is like saying the sky is blue and the grass is green. I mean, so what? I mean, if you look back at all the old command papers going back decades and decades, they all use either GDP or GNP, a gross national product, as a marker of the relative importance that all the governments, you know, Dennis Healey, Duncan Sandys, going back as far as you like, attached to the threat at that time. And the size of the forces that they needed. And this is what governments do. That's the standard metric. Doesn't matter if it's defense or health or education, Britain, France, Germany, Paraguay, it's irrelevant. So having made that defense of the metric, I have to be honest and say I'm kind of reaching the point where I'm kind of really scratching my head going, this is being devalued because the books have been cooked so fervently. And so in the 2.3%, we're already carrying elements of the intelligence budgets. We're carrying military aid to Ukraine. We're carrying defense pensions, which never used to be part of it. And I think what's happened with Pete Hegseth, the US Secretary of Defense, and Mark Rutte, is Donald Trump is coming with his 5.5% figure, which is, unless you're Poland, probably seems a bit of an unrealistic stretch. So they've agreed on 3.5%. And then this 1.5% is meant to carry all the kind of ancillary stuff. So, there's been talk of, rural broadband is counting towards defence. There's been talk of railway lines. I mean, I'm a big fan of both those things. I'm not sure the connection with defence is that obvious. So that just seems as though it's debasing the debate a little bit by going down those pathways. And I just think, who do they think they're kidding here? I mean, we're kidding ourselves, right? We're not kidding the Russians or the Chinese, because, you know, they can read the information, the open source, the military balance, whatever you like. They've got all that information. So who are we kidding? We're just kidding our own publics, really. Prior to the end of the Cold War, there was always a limit time which you could spend, even when World War II. I think we hit about 51, 52% of GDP in the middle of World War II. So we weren't spending everything on defense. But you started with an analysis of the threat and took it from there. And then after the Cold War, it was more about, well, what capabilities can we afford? You know. And this, I think the current thinking just takes it to an extreme. And what you see a lot in this SDR is, and you see this in many of them, this one in particular, is a reliance on allies. So allies can do this, allies can pick, but we haven't got the Royal Fleet Auxiliary where we needed to be. So we can rely on allies, which is obviously what's happening at the minute. It's Carrier Strike Group 25. Yeah, great. There's a problem with that. And the American problem, the American question, shall we call it, illustrates the problem perfectly, because 80% of NATO's military potential is locked up in that ally. And that ally is getting bored with NATO, okay? So if you're constantly relying on other people, and then they say, well, you know what, we've changed our mind, what do you do then? Do you know what I mean? So you become hostage to fortune, which makes me feel slightly uncomfortable. But
yeah, when you were saying that about who do you think you're kidding, it just reminded me of Dad's Army, a bit like who do you think you're kidding, Mr. Starmer, could be a good one. And the reason I mention that is because when you think about rural broadband, railway lines, maybe getting the line from wherever it is, from Plymouth to Tavistock, will become a vital defence asset, you know, so that commuters can travel up and down. But the other thing is, I think part of the problem with politicians in their own heads is they think the UK's defence is a simple. And in fact, I think the Defence Review or Talk Around It brought in something like this. It's kind of like a new Home Guard. I think they've got a Home Guard mindset. And so it's like, you know, if we dig for victory, or we have a rural broadband so the Home Guard could communicate, like a great movie called Went the Day Well. It's about the Germans invading an English village, and the plucky villagers take them on and beat them. It's actually a pretty good film. And I think they don't understand, in one way, they don't understand the huge scale of defence and what is needed, and the planning and what's needed years and years, and the effort, and how you mustn't cock it up. And so I just wonder if they do think in terms of Dad's Army. And a naval officer, submarine captain friend of mine, once described the UK armed forces as basically a bit like Dad's Army defences. Because what you've got is you've got conventional forces that whoever holds the purse strings, or military planners, whoever it is, for 20, 30 years have denuded, until they're almost like a more sophisticated Dad's Army, shall we say, Dad's Army level. And this was his point. But then up the other end of the spectrum, and this brings us to another facet of the current government and politicians in general, is you've got the nuclear deterrent, the political weapon of all political weapons, the destroyer of worlds. So they love submarines, and they love the deterrent, because it's engineering, it's jobs in areas of the country perhaps where they need to have votes, whatever. I'm being a bit cynical there, but they like that stuff. The same goes with drones. It sounds technical, it sounds industrial, and I know that the current government's been banging on about this, and there's going to be thousands of jobs in the industries, and thousands of places where things are going to be built sometime in the future. There'll be 12 SSN AUKUS by, what, 2040 or 50? I mean, we'll be dead by then. You know what I mean? And drones, they're going to rule the Atlantic. But the Atlantic isn't the Black Sea, and there'll be countermeasures, whatever. But the thing they don't really think about, because they feel uncomfortable with it, or the military are not explaining it to them, or nobody for fear of losing their jobs as First Sea Lord or Chief of the General Staff sits them down and says, what you've got to realise is that we need to go out there, defend the UK by killing the enemy, which means we've got to survive long enough to kill as many of them as we can to protect everybody else. And that means you need a lot of firepower, a lot of people, and you need to get on with it now. So a bit like Cameron, when he saved the tornado force, because allegedly, and I don't know if this is true, a senior RAF officer went to him and said, you know, you'd be better off cutting the carriers and the Harriers and all that, because we need the tornadoes, because, you know, Battle of Britain, we've got to save Britain with the RAF. And I think that's the level, and I'm probably being unkind, on which they think Dad's Army and the Battle of Britain. And so maybe you think I'm being unkind, but I think there's a problem in the military and with politicians of learning, understanding and grasping the sheer scale of the threat we face and the sheer scale and urgency of what we've got to do. And so that's why nothing ever moves, because this isn't Winston Churchill at the Admiralty, you know, in the early 20th century, who was galvanised and feverish and working on, you know, new super dreadnoughts night and day and staking the country's defences on these new battleships and a particular hardware problem. This is a bunch of politicians and a whole generation of people who just, I don't know, they just like to think of the far-off future of fantasy fleets of drones and things like that. I mean, do you agree, Gary? There's a problem with perception and education and grasping how serious and major the task is?
Yeah, I mean, just to pick up on a couple of points you've just made there, which I find myself in violent agreement with, but if you look at a country like Finland, so the reserve forces idea, so we're going to have to become more resilient and be more like Finland. Amen to that. I'm certainly not against that. And, you know, I watched a documentary the other day about Finland, and it's a remarkably cohesive society. And everybody's happy to pick up a gun and go and do their bit, you know, in a TA-type fashion. That's good. That's a really good idea. But I think that's not going to address the problems of this geostrategic threat that we face from Russia, but actually coming down the track not that long away in the future, China. I think you're living in, with respect to people, I think they're living in cloud cuckoo land. If they think you can just kind of divorce the two and say, yeah, all we have to worry about is Russia. Well, we're going to talk about Iran in a bit, right? So that's not all we have to worry about. So what I think my worry, my concern, and it goes back to your point actually earlier about the Atlantic Bastion. I think the Atlantic Bastion on paper is a nice idea. You're quite right. So where's the resource coming from to make this a reality? But I really like your other point about, you know, the Russia's bastion in the high north means that they can fire their long-range missiles at the UK with more or less impunity, unless we go and get them, right?
Yeah.
So I've been doing some reading recently. Paul Kennedy, who's a very renowned academic, he wrote The Rise and Fall of British Naval Mastery, and then The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. Produced a book in 2023, which came out, which takes many of his ideas about the relationship between strategic ideas, naval ideas, economies, and he applies all that to World War II and he the naval battles of World War II. This gets us into some relatively contentious academic area about, you know, which is better, an Alfred Mahan approach or a Julian Corbett approach, and where should the British way in warfare be in relation to those two. Now, most British people, and we're kind of brought up to believe Corbett was right for Britain and Mahan was right for America, maybe in Japan, but not so much for Britain. Because of the commercial aspects of British sea power, the need to tie the empire together. And nowadays, we would talk about defending the rules-based order, global trade, the UK is a trading nation. So the Atlantic Bastion idea fits beautifully in a Corbettian sense. So I'm in favour of it. However, what you said is also equally true, which is that, you know, to really stop the Russian threat, really, because you said they're going to hide in their bastion and not come out. So going back to the 85-86 American maritime strategy, their idea then was to send the Nimitz carriers into the bastion and just destroy everything, okay? So Kennedy makes the point, in World War II, Britain had two navies, it had a battle fleet, and it had a fleet geared for defeating the U-boats. Because out of necessity, you need both. And the Russian Navy is comparable in many respects to the Kriegsmarine. You know, Germany did not have a big Navy in 1939. That's big units, some powerful units. And it developed, obviously, its U-boat capability. But, you know, we had to destroy the surface raiders first before we could then tackle the U-boat menace, which is exactly what happened. So people will say, because the tenor of a NATO first approach and the tenor of being critical of the little bit of a tiny pivot that we've done to the IPR, the tilt, is that, you know, we get to choose. We get to choose. And because the finances are limited and resources are limited, we get to choose. That's wrong. And I fear that the reason why some people are comfortable with 2.5%, a cooked 2.5%, is distance. Because the one massive advantage we have is we're an island, right? And it's true, the Russian army is not coming here anytime soon, if ever. But that's not the threat posed by Russia, and maybe even China down the track. The threat is a sea and air-based threat. And we, I think, psychologically, have lulled ourselves into a false sense of security because of the sea. The sea is only a benefit if we control it. If we don't control it, it's a hazard because it's a highway. People talk about, you know, NATO first, East of Suez, Atlantic, Indian Ocean. Yeah, but it's all contiguous. It's all joined up, okay? People say, a carrier strike group, why are we going out off there? You know, what happens if the war kicks off tomorrow in our backyard? Well, like, as the CDS said the other day, well, you just turn around and come back, right? So I think in the desperation to kind of fit into this 2.5% parameter, which is cooked, and you talk about replenishing nuclear, it's really hard to get your head into this data, right? It's opaque, it's obscured. But as best as I can make out, I think the real figure for conventional forces, or sort of conventional deterrence, is about 1.6, 1.7%. Nuclear is taking up 0.5%, as far as I can work out, right? Which is not supposed to do, but it is. I think here there's a comparison with, the fact is a lot of skills have atrophied over time, you know, in places like Aldermaston. We're having to recapitalize those skills. Sound familiar? Sounds a lot like the astute class, you know, Farrago. So consequently, the cost of recapitalizing is that much higher because it's almost like a blank piece of paper. We're starting again. And it's the conventional forces that are being hit. And here's why that's a really bad thing. I mean, I'm all in favor of having a nuclear deterrent. But what we've observed most clearly is that the utility of nuclear weapons is very narrow. They're very, very powerful, but they're very, very narrow. The weapons of choice are all conventional, okay? So if we end up fighting the Russians and we end up in a situation where they've achieved escalation dominance on day one, you know, I mean, I don't want to segue too much into it, but Operation Spiderweb, that brilliant Ukrainian operation in the heart of Russia, in both Siberia and the Arctic, where they knocked out 12 so-called strategic bombers. As many people online commented, well, what about that? We've got all our peers, Poseidon's kind of like in a row, in a line at Lossiemouth. We need to disperse them. So I worry. I just think we're lulled into a false sense of security because, ironically, because we're an island in the North Atlantic. But that's not how it works.
No. Before we pivot ourselves to Iran and all that, I'll just get on one of my hobby horses, which the magazine's on at the moment itself, in connection with the Bastions and everything else, and in what you were just saying there, which is that if we look at the submarine service and nuclear submarines, they've been put at the centre. It says so in the Defence Review that the continuous at-sea deterrent force is the, you know, the foundation of national security. But with that goes attack submarines, SSNs, and then also other defences like ASW frigates, Merlins, you know, submarine hunting Merlins, whatever, Poseidons. But the thing that's missing, if they want to achieve the ambition of, you know, 12 SSNs by 2040 or whenever it'll eventually be, and, you know, and even want to think beyond Dreadnought to the next ballistic missile submarine, is they need to have a viable submarine service that can do, there can be two fleets. You mentioned two fleets. One fleet is committed, let's say, to sending one or two Astute class or AUKUS SSNs to Australia, maybe with a carrier in the future, in the decades to come, to operate there. That is a nuclear powered submarine with the reach, the speed, the armament to be useful in that part of the world. And then there's the other fleet, which has to watch out for the Russians, who have a growing and very impressive undersea warfare force, conventional, unconventional, and all the rest of it, a threat to our pipelines and our cables. So to create the structure of the submarine force that feeds through the future petty officers, senior ratings, and commanding officers for the SSN AUKUS and the dreadnoughts, let's say in the mid-2030s up to 2040, you need to have a viable human skills base, and you need to have a force structure that gives young people encouragement to join the submarine service. That means an active one, one that's out there doing an important job that helps the nation's defences. It can't be a submarine service that has two SSNs and one SSBN out there, and the SSBN people are being driven to the edge of endurance of 6 month patrols, and the people that want to be in the SSNs are not getting to sea, and they're not being trained, and the morale must be suffering from across the service due to that, and it does across the Navy due to a lot of different problems. But if the politicians and everybody else are serious about the submarine service needs to be a national enterprise and restructure the submarine service, restore to it the ability to offer one fleet, SSNs, carriers that could do the big stuff out in the big oceans and maybe up in the Barents, but also have, maybe some SSNs might be involved in this as well, but air independent propulsion, conventional submarines, 8 of them. And that would restore the career ladder, the training ability, the activity, and the morale and the ethos and the killer instinct, and create and fulfill a submarine force that can actually meet those expectations by the time SSN AUKUS and the dreadnoughts are out there. And that you know, we were talking about the 3% and the 5% and everything else. Rather than give Captain Mannering, the future Captain Mannering, and private bike, good broadband, and an ability to use one of those things you put on the rail that you pump up and down, that was in the movie Blazing Saddles, if you've ever seen it. I can't remember what they're called. But, you know, for the Dad's army to go off, and oh, some Russians have just landed up by North Devon. Right, come on, lads. You know, because that's how I think. I do wonder, I'm taking the mickey a bit. That's how they think. They need to get serious about what we really need to invest in. And frigates are great, but submarines are the key capability for the UK. And so maybe somebody thought about that in the SDSR, and that didn't even make it onto the wish list. You know, I don't know. But they really ought to think about it. And it's very, very serious, because how we get from here, and it goes into industry as well, construction, maintenance, refitting, whatever you want to call it, how we get from here to the wonderland of 12 SSNs and the dreadnoughts, et cetera, I have no idea, unless they really dig in on the Navy personnel and submarine service side.
I mean, I agree with all of that. I mean, one thing I would say in the document, which I actually thought was reasonably good, but it didn't mention those specifics at all, but there seems to be an appreciation that they need to get the basics right, and the basics are badly out of kilter. So on things like recruitment and retention, there's a pledge there to spend several billions on new housing. So, you know, that stops people leaving, I guess. And on things like the basics in terms of like munitions, so building new armaments factories, there's a kind of a slightly ambiguous pledge to produce 7,000 long-range weapons. So I think there's an understanding that they need to improve the offer to people. And I think on diesel submarines, diesel-powered submarines, you know, of course, they'll have fairly lean crews. So, you know, you don't need as many people to crew them these days. I forget the figures for the German.
About 30.
Okay, so that's very lean crew. Very lean crewing, and I believe I'm right in saying, you know, generally speaking, when it comes to warships, it's if you've got three, you can put one at sea. But I think the deployment ratio is a bit better for SSKs, something like 1 and 2. So, I mean, that would make a lot of sense. I think for that to actually happen, the fact that it didn't even make it into the Sunday Times leaks suggests you probably need your 3.5% for that to then be get put on the table. I mean, it would make a lot of sense.
Yeah, yeah. But the thing is, they've got the Excalibur drone that's mentioned in the current magazine, which is great. You know, everybody's got to have them. Drones are essential. But at the moment, it's a very large self-propelled, or it will be when it's got the equipment in it, a very large self-propelled sonar buoy. You know, more sophisticated, obviously, but there's lots of complexity there in these things, and they are essential, and they will work with submarines in the future. Of course they will. But you must have something that's flexible, fast, can take a decision to kill a target immediately or carry out a range of other things like land special forces, conduct surveillance, intelligence gathering, blah, 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 all that stuff that all submarines can do on top of it. So Excalibur is great, but it isn't actually a submarine. So that's one of the other things, you know, about the review. You know, drones are not actually a substitute for real firepower or real naval forces.
No, I agree. I mean, one final point for me is that there's some good tech that and, you know, I sometimes come across, I think, as kind of being a technophobe, but something like AI, for example, I think is quite transformative. And I don't think it's like a sci-fi version of it where it takes over the world. I think that's a load of nonsense. But I think in terms of helping people get inside the opposition OODA loop by being able to kind of fuse all that sensor and process it, sensor data, and process it really quickly and give the operator, you know, options, fantastic. You still need something at the end of the kill chain. You still need heavy metal at the end of the kill chain. And that's, I think, what's often absent in British kind of defense policy is that there's this assumption that it's all about tech. And, you know, there's no need for the heavy ordnance and the platforms and the people. But actually, the tech's irrelevant unless you connect it all together. But because it's like sexy, people go, oh, AI, blah, blah, blah. And therefore, kind of people get bedazzled by it. And some people think, yeah, it's like Terminator. But I mean, you look at it, as far as I can tell, it's nothing like that at all. There is some positives. So there's some positives in the document. I wouldn't want to poo-poo it entirely, but ultimately I agree. I think until we actually reconstitute the forces, which is what we're talking about, what we've got now is almost like a cadre. They're almost like training cadres. There's nothing, not a lot there. I mean, the number of ships that are deployed, I mean, proper first line warships, there's about four or five deployed, you know, and bearing in mind what's going on in the world, it's not enough.
No, and segueing into that, you know, things going on at the moment, it's another factor, another thing that suddenly cropped up within, you know, a short period of the SDR document trying to put a stake in the ground. We've now got this explosion of another war in the Gulf. I was going to say the Middle East, but there's already war raging in the Middle East. There was, of course, one starting late October 23 and has ended up in the war in Gaza. And then we had the Houthis and then versus the US Navy, very intense combat and also a bombing campaign, which was called off in the end by mutual agreement, I would say, between the Americans and Houthis. But now on the other side of Arabia and arguably much, much more dangerous, we've now got the Israel versus Iran thing, in which it appears that Iran's superpower qualities in terms of drones have not lived up to expectations, because the Israelis claim to have been able to dominate the skies above Tehran and are taking out various Iranian military people, nuclear scientists and missile sites. But of course, the Iranians are getting missiles through to Israel. And so that war is raging. We have the US Navy has one carrier strike group there, the USS Carl Vinson, as we speak. The USS Nimitz is on the way and I think will soon be in the Arabian Sea. Who knows? I don't know. I've not got any knowledge of their movements, but she's on her way. But then another one, although this carrier is a replacement, really, for the Carl Vinson, you might say, is the USS Gerald R. Ford, the most modern carrier that the US Navy's got. And they've all got carrier strike groups. And so they're all gathering in case President Trump decides he could have done it by the time we come out with this podcast, but we must hurry up and get it out there before he takes a decision, so we're not completely out of date. But he may well have decided that we're going to go in on giving them our deep penetration munitions or whatever. There's been a lot of stuff moved around, aircraft, tankers. So here we are. The US Navy is getting ready. The US forces are in action. The RAF has been sent some more jets to Cyprus to defend Cyprus. The UK carrier strike group is currently not in waters off Arabia. It's heading for Australia. And at least one ship is at Singapore at the moment. And that's an air defence destroyer. You mentioned an air defence destroyer earlier. So looking at that situation, Gary, thinking about all the multitudes of levels, not least a lot of British people that could soon be, feeling very insecure, who are in the United Arab Emirates and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. What is your overview of the Israel-Iran war? You know, what do you see about it and the implications for us all?
What Israel's doing is essentially a preventive exercise. They're trying to. This isn't. There isn't an imminent attack. They just don't want Iran to have this weapon, and you can kind of understand why, because Iran has used Hezbollah, and it's used Hamas to attack Israel, and recently it attacked Israel outright, and the Americans and indeed the British got involved in defending Israel there, and it used ballistic missiles to do so. So, and it would appear they've got some intelligence that the level of uranium enrichment has reached the threshold where it's very, very close to being able to weaponize the nuclear stocks, their fissile material. And estimates vary, but they might have enough fissile material to create something like 10 to 15 nuclear weapons. So Netanyahu has taken the decision to act now. Simultaneously, Trump has been piling the pressure on Iran. He's saying, look, I want to do a deal with you, but you're not having a nuclear weapon. So the Iranians are caught between a rock and a hard place here, I think. And I think to be fair to Trump, he's been very, very consistent about this throughout, over time. He's always said Iran isn't going to have a nuclear weapon. And they are in breach of their non-proliferation obligations. The problem, I guess, so what tactically might happen? Obviously, the Israelis have already been striking some of these targets, but they don't have the massive ordnance penetrator weapon, which fits onto a B-2 bomber and it can penetrate to 200 feet before exploding. And it must be said also that the Americans only have a finite number of these weapons. So again, estimates vary because this is classified, but people seem to think it's in the region of 20 to 50. So they might have to use several of these at each site, such as Fordo, uranium enrichment plant. So they might have to use 3-4 to actually destroy the facility outright. So what might it mean for the rest of the world? I suppose the obvious worry that people have is that it could lead to Iran to close the Strait of Hormuz. Something like a quarter of the world's oil flows through the Strait of Hormuz. I'm skeptical that they'll actually do this because that would really hurt the Iranian economy at a time when they're in dire straits anyway. And their ally, or their putative ally, China, gets about 45% of its oil through that strait as well. And there's no obvious way it could get oil from elsewhere. It gets a lot from Russia nowadays as well. So the Chinese would not want them to do that. Now, it could be that if the theocratic regime in Iran is just about to kind of collapse, that they might say, well, we're going to do it anyway, regardless of the consequences, because, everything's gone up the spout. So we're going to actually just kind of do this. And obviously that would have a very negative effect in terms of oil prices, which bleeds through into inflation, etc., and could lead to things getting very kinetic in the Persian Gulf. And I could quite imagine a scenario where the UK gets involved in that reluctantly. The UK clearly does not want to get directly involved in this. It's got a big question it has to answer almost certainly regarding the infamous Diego Garcia, because it's probable that the Americans will ask to use that base. And if they're going to use the B-2 bombers with the GBU-57 weapon, it's probably going to come from Diego Garcia. My hunch is, there's no good options here for the Americans or the Israelis or the Iranians. There's a cost to intervening. Obviously, there always is, but there's also always a cost to not intervening. And I think because the Israelis have softened up the Iranians to the extent that they have, I think Trump will go for it.
It strikes me that the only way the British could be involved in it is defensively, really, is if the Iranians attack, let's say, Bahrain, where there's a British base. Now, whether or not there are any vessels in Bahrain now, there was a hint the other day that that the Americans had cleared out their vessels. I don't know anything about Royal Navy vessels. And also the French, they have a base, I believe, in Abu Dhabi. And so, you know, the French will probably not want to be actively involved in the offensive side of it. So, and then we've got the threat to trade again, maybe in Bab el-Mandeb Strait on the other side of the Arabian Peninsula between Africa and Yemen. And so I think it's a bit of, for us, it's a bit of back to the future, because of course we had the 80s tanker war and the Royal Navy was pretty active in escorting merchant ships under attack from Iranian and Iraqi missiles, etc., and the mine threat as well, and other things. And it was the Americans who, towards the end of that that whole thing in the late 1980s, they were the ones that were involved in the kinetic side of it, because they had one warship, one frigate mined, and the other one hit by, I think, two Exocet missiles, the Stark. And so then we had this big punch-up called Operation Praying Mantis, which the Iranian Navy was basically given a right good old mauling. And actually, I did a feature based on a book I wrote, putting in a book plug there, as it were, about the tanker war. We ran it over four parts. So, I mean, as somebody else said, and I can't remember where it was recently, it was somebody on X said that really what you're looking at here is a series of wars going right back to, let's say, 1980, the early 80s, through Desert Storm and all the rest of it, the Iraq War, and all the various other little incidents that have happened, the Houthis, etc. This is all one big contest between the West and the Iranians and other countries there, Iraq, Iran, but mainly the Iranians and the West at sea, and et cetera, et cetera. And now we're reaching some kind of culminating point. So whether that's, total war, as it were, between Iran and America and Israel, I don't know. And we'll see what President Trump decides.
Well, I mean, as I've said before, I don't think Trump is a fan of war per se, right? He just isn't. And he's definitely not a liberal interventionist, because he's always criticizing liberal interventionists. Does not follow that he's not prepared to use the military instrument. He has done that before, particularly in relation to Iran. I don't think he's got any interest in regime change per se. The Israelis might. I think the Israelis have interest in regime change. But even there, I think what they're not, this isn't going to be like 2003 in Iraq or Afghanistan. No one's going to try and create a liberal democracy. If the Iranian people, I mean, the regime is very unpopular, particularly with young people. If they were somehow able to rise up and overthrow, the Ayatollahs and the IRGC, then, yeah, that would be probably chalk that up as a win. But I don't think that's what's going to happen here. So I think if Khamenei bent the knee and said, yeah, okay, you can... We'll get rid of the nuclear facilities. I think Trump would say, yeah, okay, I'll take that. But equally, if he doesn't, I think he will definitely use the weapons. I mean, it could happen today, it could happen tomorrow. I think the mass transit of American military forces into the region, it's partly about hitting Iranian nuclear facilities, but I think it's primarily about if there's an Iranian reaction to the various military bases, American military bases across the region, then or the Houthis start firing up again, the Americans are likely to try and sanitize the whole nine yards. I think that's why they're putting so much kit in there. On the UK position, personally, I'm really surprised that we haven't sent a Type 45 destroyer to Cyprus, because we know that the Sea Viper system has a capability against short-range ballistic missiles. And the Sky Saber system, which is in situ in Cyprus, doesn't. I find that quite surprising. There's some whispers about that. That's because we don't have enough sailors available to actually send one. Carrier Strike Group, you're right, HMS Dauntless docked in Singapore today, which is with the Carrier Strike Group. So that seems to have been taken out of the equation. There was an interesting piece yesterday I read. Somebody was saying that the government, Starmer, could have said to the Americans, we'll throw that into the mix. you know, 20 F-35s, which has significantly enhanced the F-35 contribution overall. And the argument was that if he did that, he could then have some control of American and Israeli decision-making.
Well, yeah.
I mean, I don't think that was ever going to happen, but it was an interesting point of view.
I was just checking here when you were mentioning Type 45, as we're near the end of this. Yeah. 16th of May, 2025, HMS Dragon launched missiles against a maneuvering, that's the caveat, a maneuvering supersonic missile, and that's a Type 45. So there is one that's very recently been involved in a NATO exercise to actually tackle ballistic missiles. HMS Diamond shot down a Houthi ballistic missile, loads of drones out there in the Red Sea. And so there is a Type 45, as you said, at Singapore, which is HMS Dauntless. She probably wouldn't go, and Dragon's available. So the Navy's there. There'll be a reason why they haven't done it. But as you say, it is surprising. Whatever happens, even by the time this podcast is posted, I think we've had a good chat, and it's for the record. And we've put our thoughts out there. And thanks very much for that, Gary. That's very good.
My pleasure, Ian.
Connect with us via social media on X and Facebook. And in both cases, that's at WarshipsIFR. And you can also find us on YouTube at WarshipsIFR TV. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on your podcast app. Keep your eye on the horizon for our next episode.